Hello and welcome to the Data Protection Made Easy podcast, episode 206 on the 21st of February 2025. This week, I'm Phil Brining. In fact, I'm always Phil Brining, but this week I was joined by Joe Kirk.
Good afternoon, Phil.
How are you doing? Sorry about my slip up there.
That's all right. Yes. All good. Thanks. How did you...
Good session, wasn't it, I thought?
I think so. Yeah. I agree.
I thought there was a lot of interaction on, particularly on qualifications, on the book. You know, there's a lot of good stuff there.
Yeah, yeah. Roper's as well was quite an interesting. You were giving us a bit of a background into your week. You've been working with Excel, haven't you? The frustrations of building a Roper on Excel is something that we all have probably experienced in our time as working in the field of data protection.
Yeah, and there were some good suggestions how to kind of get Excel working better, like putting in embedded objects and also these things called focus cells, which I've not heard of before in Excel. So I need to find out what they do. But that was like, we spent quite a long time actually talking about, it wasn't so much Roper's, was it? It was consent and withdrawal of consent. We had a really good chat about that. I thought it was quite good. And then we lent on some of the stuff that the ICO has done in their consent of pay guidance the other week, particularly when it comes to consent and imbalance of power. So I thought that was a really good discussion, actually. That took up most of the session, didn't it? At least half.
Agree. Yeah, I think it did. Took about half an hour. But there's quite a lot to unpack with regards to consent, isn't there? Obviously, we're trying to explore the withdrawal of consent and what that means for the processing, because I'd read a privacy notice earlier this week, that kind of said around the that once you've withdrawn your consent, we will delete your data unless it could be processed on another legal ground. So we kind of explored that and what that means and whether we believe that that is feasible in practice, I guess. So you're right. Yeah, a lot to unpick around that. But I think that was my highlight of the session.
Yeah, I think that's how we got into it, didn't we? You were talking about withdrawal of consent and all of a sudden, like 25 minutes had gone by and we were talking about a whole range of connected items. The other thing that I thought we spoke a lot about, I had a couple of soapbox moments, didn't I? Which, again, I'm not sure
people you did, decide yeah.
whether or not. Yeah. Yeah. Anyway, then there was a bit in the news about Apple and the encryption request from the UK government, and a case in Texas which we quite liked as well, talking about the new Texan data protection law.
Yes, and then the ICO. Released in an interview that they believe the DUA bill will achieve royal assent in spring. So, well, spring starts a week tomorrow. Obviously, it goes on until the end of May. So it could be quite a quick turnaround with that. It's in the House of Commons, I believe, at the moment, isn't it? It's on its second reading, I think. So
I think so.
We'll provide updates where we can when we know of them.
Yeah. Perfect. Right. Well, I'm going to disappear and have some lunch. So on that note, dive in the session and see what you think.
The enjoyable phase of writing up audit reports. So that's pretty much been my week.
I thought you had bruising on your forehead.
Smashing my head against the keyboard. Yeah, quite. Yeah. So, yeah, the last, like, 3 or 4 weeks I've been down to London a handful of times on a couple of different audits. So at the start of the week, I was writing up the audit that I did about 2 weeks ago, trying to remember what we spoke about and try and make sense of my notes. And then towards the back end of the week, starting to write up the stuff from last week's audit. And it's not easy in terms of trying to sift back through your notes, trying to remember what you spoke about on site and thinking, sure, I made a note of this, and then you can't find it, you're just shot, you're thinking, my word. But yes, it's quite it's I don't want to give too much away. It's good, I enjoy it.
It's just all right about, isn't it? But it's quite challenging sometimes, especially if you've got lots of ground you're covering, and they're brilliant, but they're very intense, aren't they?
You come back and then you're trying to triangulate things through the Roper and the privacy notices, and if the Roper is not clear, if they've used keys or whatever, you have to sift through tabs to try and make sense of what's actually going on. It just really just slow you down.
Yeah, but like I say, it is a good process, and you cover a lot of ground in a day, so there's an awful lot of information to take in, isn't there? So it's not easy for an auditor. I sympathise with you.
yes, you've probably got the most experience out of anyone that I know anyway in relation to audits, but that's not, I don't know too many people, I guess, in the world of privacy.
yeah, out of me and me, I've got the most experience. Fine, fair enough. But I thought your audit report you sent through for QA last week was good.
Thank you very much.
The wording up a little bit, as I said to you, you know. Yeah. But in general, I think that the evidence was good and the ratings, I thought, you know, on the same page as you, so I attended that audit as well. So, yeah, very good. Well done. Hopefully a solid action plan, quite a few recommendations and a few non-compliances to get on with and how to do it. So I think, you know, the feedback we get from customers is very, very useful, isn't it, to get that external independent audit done and then the audit report is lengthy, and if you can be bothered to read it, then it does contain a lot of information. But
yes, and I think they're useful exercises, especially from an external organization, because I think internally, when you're looking at the same document over and over every day, if you're looking at Europa, you know, for years on end, and I think you just become used to it and you're not really kind of aware of any sort of potential issues or inaccuracies. So just having a fresh set of eyes that's kind of separate from the organization, I think, can just do you a world of good in just trying to pick up on a couple of things that you may have not noticed.
Yeah, and we often ask different questions, don't we, as well, you know, sort of extend the link things together that don't necessarily be linked together in terms of elements of compliance, and then maybe ask a different level of a question, because we're not operational in there, we're looking at it from the outside, we don't make any preconceptions.
Yes, agree. I don't know how you want to kind of start this podcast, but there was, I think we could probably quite nicely link it to my audits, because I've, in the process of doing the audit write-up stuff, I went back and had a look at one of the privacy notices of the organization that I was auditing.
Yeah.
And I came across a statement. It was in the right section, so talking about the withdrawal of consent. And in the privacy notice, it said, you have the right to withdraw your consent for that specific processing activity at any time. Once the notification that you have withdrawn consent has been received, Organization X will no longer process the information for the purpose or purposes originally agreed to, unless there is another legitimate basis for doing so in law. Now, I saw that and I thought, hang on a minute, that doesn't quite sit right with me. So, you know, besides the point, in the audit report, I kind of put my thoughts of kind of why I think that's not quite right. And I actually ended up speaking to Kate about it, Katerina, and she then went and sent me a link to the European Commission's website that was around kind of the question was, what if somebody withdraws the consent, was the question that was asked. And then the European Commission provided an answer. And they said that it should be as easy to withdraw as to give consent. And if consent is withdrawn, your company / organization can no longer process the data. But then it went on to say that once consent has been withdrawn, your company or organization needs to ensure that the data is deleted unless it can be processed on another legal ground. For example, storage requirements, or as far as it is a necessity, fulfill the contract. But I don't know about you, but there's kind of the wording around kind of, once you've withdrawn your consent, if you can then apply another lawful basis, that just doesn't sit right with me. I don't know if it was me misinterpreting the guidance from the EU Commission, or if it's, I just think it sets a dangerous precedent.
Yeah, let me ask you a question. You say the European Commission's website, not the European Data Protection Board's guidance or website. So this was the European Commission itself as a body. Because the UK government isn't necessarily got things right. You know, it's not the fount of all knowledge, unlike arguably the European Data Protection Board is.
Yes. Yeah, it was European Commission. Yeah.
Yeah. So it wouldn't be a surprise if they were if they had information that was not wholly accurate or was slightly true. I mean, of course, the ICO's view is that if you're working on the basic consent, once consent's been withdrawn, that's it. It's game over. You can't do anything else with it. That's their view, isn't it?
Yeah, and I agree to an extent, but then also not at the same time, if that makes sense. So I think what kind of the, I think that in that privacy notice, I think that just sets a dangerous precedent that the organization is, if someone withdraws a consent, oh, we're going to go, hang on a minute, we just might alter this lawful basis to legitimate interest, for example, and that will allow us to continue processing the data. That I agree, that shouldn't carry any weight. But I think where you kind of can change lawful grounds is if you get it wrong, if that makes sense. Because I think, you know, when we speak with customers, you know, we sometimes we'll look at Europa that's not been touched since, you know, 2018 when the GDPR was implemented. And people do get things wrong. And, you know, someone could have chosen consent as a lawful basis because there is that misconception that consent's the only way that you can share data, for example. So, you know, people do get things wrong. And I think if it is very clearly the wrong lawful basis, and it's we spoke a little bit, didn't we, before the podcast, and used the example of, say, you rely on my consent to process my data to manage my employment. You need my information to pay me, to manage my employment, to pay me, you know, my wage. So if you rely on consent and then you get advice from a third party like us, for example, and we say that's probably not the best route to go down, performance of a contract will be a lot more appropriate, then you're kind of not really given a choice but to change the lawful basis. Because if you carry on relying on consent, then that's just going to hinder your business operations, I guess. So, but I think if you do that, it is a bit, you've got to be a bit careful, haven't you? I think if you are doing that, I think you've got to justify your reason for doing so and inform the data subjects that this has happened.
Yeah.
And explain why.
I think in reality, there's every chance that lawful basis may change. It might not be wrong. It might be also an evolution. So it might be that you start off with something based on consent and over time realize actually there could be an imbalance of power. Now, on that subject, I've just read through the European Data Protection Board's guidance on the ICO's guidance, sorry, on consent or pay. And in that, they go through in quite a lot of detail, actually, the kind of exploring the concept of imbalance of power, which is really quite interesting to read. Not necessarily in relation to the consent or pay scenario, but in general, this kind of notion of imbalance of power. So you might come to the conclusion after a period of time, actually, whilst it wasn't overtly obvious at first as an imbalance of power, actually there probably is. We've done some evaluations over time. Things have changed. So it could be that the processing or the nature of the processing or the context of the processing has changed and evolved over time. And it's appropriate maybe to change the lawful basis. So what we're talking about, though, is we don't want to mix two things up together. What we're talking about is withdrawal of consent and then flipping to another lawful basis, as opposed to recognizing actually we might have this wrong. We're going to change the lawful basis for processing. So we don't want to mix the two things up.
Yeah, there are two elements to it, aren't there? But yeah, I mean, it just didn't sit right with me that I think that sort of, and I know that you should never kind of, we even say, don't we? We don't always agree with the ICO at times, and if you always take it with a pinch of salt. So kind of, I just think it sets a dangerous precedent, though, kind of saying that once it's been withdrawn, unless, you know, we'll delete it unless we can find another lawful ground to carry on processing.
Yeah, that's possibly just clunky wording. I'm going to come to what Petra's saying in a minute, because I think it's really, as Emma says, a really fantastic question. But what we're doing, it may be just clunky wording. So when we're going through in our privacy information, you know, the purpose of processing, the lawful basis of processing, etc., at that point, you might be able to articulate better the ability to withdraw consent or object to processing, depending if it's on consent or legitimate interest. But when you get down to the actual rights section, you know, we're obliged to tell people what their rights are. Mm. And you know, the right to withdraw consent, I would probably just leave it as that. The more words you add, the more complicated it gets. So the intention isn't to say, well, if we don't agree with that, we're going to try and find another lawful basis. Maybe it's just bad wording on a privacy notice. But with bad wording on privacy notice, you end up boxing yourselves into a corner if you're not careful.
I agree. Yeah. It always kind of baffles me when I go to the right section and then there's a real detailed kind of description about it. Just for me, in my opinion, I'd just put the right to withdraw consent. You can maybe put a little bit of text after that kind of saying that, you know, it's I don't know, it's not really necessary, is it? I don't think.
No, like the right to object, you know, some people, or erasure, some people say you have the right to erasure under certain circumstances, such as blah 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 blah. Why bother in a privacy notice? You know, why not just say you have the right to erasure or rectification, you know?
Yeah,
full stop. You know, the more we put in them, sometimes the more complicated they get.
Yes, I agree.
Now, Petra's question here, or point she's making, is hitting the nail absolutely on the head, isn't it? Which is that when we're processing, in a complex scenario, we're processing personal data for multiple purposes, maybe one of which is based on consent. So consent gets withdrawn for that purpose. And that, you know, one of the things I bang on about, I suppose, is processing being purpose-orientated, you know, without the purpose. Like, that's why I don't like information asset registers. I like ROPAs, because information asset registers are pots of data. They're not purpose oriented. They're not intention oriented, are they? They're just pots of data. Whereas ROPAs, by definition, are purpose oriented. You've got to put in them the purpose of the processing, as you do in privacy information. So you can withdraw your consent for one particular type of processing activity. You know, that's what the consent gets withdrawn for, not everything else. It's complicated in reality, isn't it? That's one of the things about the GDPR. In reality, you know, you've got name, address, whatever you've got about people. Well, you're going to use that data for all sorts of different purposes. People can't necessarily withdraw their consent for that item of data to get used, but they withdraw their consent to the processing that's being undertaken. And again, I know we understand that as privacy practitioners, but I'm not sure that it's kind of people that think it through in those ways.
Yeah, and I don't like the notion of where it says that once you withdraw your consent, we'll delete your data, because why is that kind of stated? That's not the requirement of the law, is it? It just says that once you withdraw the data, you must cease processing. You don't have to delete the data, do you?
No. So one great example, you might repurpose it. Well, so one great example is direct marketing. You know, direct marketing, especially digital direct marketing, has to be based on consent. No option because of the PECA, on the soft option, etc. But let's assume it's based on consent. Now, somebody withdraws their consent to process for direct marketing. You really ought to move them, their information, onto a suppression list, so you know you've had that withdrawal of consent. So you're still processing the data, but for a different purpose, the purpose of a suppression list, to make sure you can comply with the PECA. But again, we can't muddle these things up. We've got to be able to strip them out into their component elements of processing activities.
Yes, I agree. But that's not the case if the lawful basis has changed. It's the processing activities changed, and you can use it same. So maybe what they're trying to say is that you might withdraw your consent, but we may need to retain the data for other reasons, such as to keep it on a suppression list, or, you know, there's a disciplinary, for example, to do with a processing activity that was relied on consent. But it's not a case of, you have drawn your consent, we're going to change to legitimate interest. It's just the processing activity is just changing from, I don't know, you know, emailing you via direct marketing to keeping your information on a suppression list to make sure that we don't send you direct marketing after you've drawn your consent. And it's the same for erasure requests as well, right? People, you know, you'll get people who say, I want to erase all my data that you have of me. That, you know, that doesn't always stand up in practice, because if I put an erasure request into DPP, you'll say, well, we need all this information to manage you as an employee, for starters. And then also you'll put me on a log of a erasure request with my name to say this person's put a request in to erase all his data, so that you know that he's put that in.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly, yeah. Exactly. And this is one of the areas, I think, that the GDPR, I think, is a fantastic tool for placing obligations onto data controllers and processors and others. And I think it's very flexible, but in some areas it is unnecessary. Well, it's more rigid than the reality of data and data processing. That's it.
Yeah, it can be. But I also think, not where it goes wrong is that I think people just don't quite interpret it correctly. And I'm not blaming anyone for that. It's not easy to do at times. But I think people see it on at face value of erasure request. I'm going to ask you to erase all my data. That means the organization absolutely must delete everything. But that's just not the case, is it? But people see the right to erasure and don't really do any digging and any research to see what that actually means in practice. And just, you often see, don't you, people often complain about organizations' practices, saying, you've done this without my consent, for example. But, you know, consent's just one of six lawful basis that could be applied.
Misconception. But I mean, you can see, like, erasure, if you've got like a digital platform and you've got data on, like, photographs, for instance, on is it Vimeo that does photographs? Can't remember now. We were talking last week presumably about dating. Interesting how that went. Your Valentine's Day podcast.
Oh, it was good.
You're looking surprised. Was that dating? I wasn't talking about dating, but dating websites. So you put your profile up on a dating website. You do what you do with these things. Put up a load of photographs of yourself, maybe, and then you get cold feet, you change your mind, and you want to make sure there's no record of it there. So you put in an erasure request. Now, you're putting an erasure request for all of that content, aren't you, really? But ultimately, the platform would probably have to retain a copy of your rights request in its governance type of processing activities. So, again, erasure request, erase everything you've got about me in the context of dating. I get that, but yeah. You know, then will be a residue, should be a residue of data left, so they know that they used to have user data subject.
Yeah,
they don't necessarily need to know what you had there, but you know.
Yeah, well, I think where you often see this is it's objections to direct marketing, isn't it? People get a little bit, you know, touchy when someone markets to them without the consent, and they say, right, I want you to remove me from your marketing list and erase your
take
record
me
of me.
Take me off your database.
But I need to make sure that I keep you on record to make sure that I don't market to you again, because that's an infringement in itself.
Yeah. Take me off your marketing list is what should be said.
Yes.
But anyway. But that whole come back to kind of the ROPA projects I've been working on, you know, trying to work with Excel to capture the complexities of the cross-border flows of data and multiple processes. It's really, really hard. I read an article about the key compliance challenges of GDPR and strategies to address them. I thought, oh, this sounds like a fantastic read. Now, the challenges were good, you know, like data mapping and inventory being like the top challenge. I would agree with that. I think that is probably the biggest challenge of all, but the strategies were really, I can't remember, I didn't bother writing them down, they were so weak, like, you know, get an external person to help you. All right, that's a great strategy, that is. You know, but I mean, you know, it is quite tricky, isn't it, to go through and tease out and if you tease it out too far, you get like a million rows in your ROPA, and so you've got to then try and bulkify it up together again. I think that's one of the big challenges, isn't it, to get that documentation about right so it makes sense.
Yes, but you're right. There's no right or wrong way, is there, about Europa and how granular you go and how superficial you go. I think as soon as it starts to be different, other kind of, if you're looking at like a process activity as a whole, and so say, for example, sending direct marketing, there's a lot of elements, isn't there, to doing direct marketing. There's the sending the materials, there's collating it, and you know, it's the notion of wanting to send the direct marketing, then actually sending it, and then also keeping a record of the suppression list. You know, there's three elements to the processing in a way. Mm. So, you know, how does that look on a ROPA? Do you have, I think the best way to probably have that is managing direct marketing under legitimate interest, and then having a separate one for the sending of the actual communication, and then managing the information is the notion of wanting to send direct marketing materials to people, and then managing like a suppression list and probably split it that way. But you know, that's quite easy on the face of it, but other things can be really quite complex, can't it? So it's unfortunate we don't have an answer, do we?
No, I don't think there is a right answer. And even if you get a right answer now, maybe 3 years time, it changes for a variety of reasons. The ROPA project I was doing this writing up this morning was about, it's a destination, and it's a tour site destination. And they get visitors, either walk-ins or tour buses, or people come in, you know, private drivers. Private drivers get commission, and again, trying to tease out the different strands of processing, you know, and then so some of that is managing visitors and access control. Some of it's managing bookings. Some of it's paying the drivers their commission, and it just making sure that when you read the ROPA, you can actually visualize the processing and it makes sense. If it's too bulked up, you just read it, you can't understand what's going on. You have to be able to understand the processing. And that means that some of the, I mean, the sheet when I first started with it had data validation on. Well, unless you put Visual Basic into your spreadsheet, you can only pick one item on a data validation list. So, you know, if you've got data subjects, you know, you can only pick one type of data subjects unless you add with a huge validation list, like all the different combinations. So the first thing I did was take that off, because I want to write free text in. Now I'm always against free text because people type things wrong, including myself as well. So, but you know, if you put validation on the wrong things, you end up with awful information. So there was instead of like taking blood type, and because that was what was in the data validation thing, blood type, high eye color signature, and something else, fingerprints, you know. And you know, do you take this stuff? No, we don't collect that, we just get a signature on it. Right, okay. But that was what was bundled together.
I think it makes sense to have data validation for things like lawful basis, because they are what they are, aren't they? But types of,
as long as you only pick one of them.
Well, yes, true. I mean, to be fair, that's something I've seen in a recent ROPA, is one I've looked at recently was there was a key for the types of personal data that were processed. So H was health data, and there was loads. Okay. So, but I mean, I don't know if I didn't like it at all, because trying to work out what was being processed, I had to go to a different worksheet on the Excel, try and work out, remember what was in the previous one, look at it there, okay, it means that and that. And then the lawful basis, that was with a key as well. And then there was somewhere there was like three in one box, and it's because three could apply. But just because three could apply doesn't mean that you put three. For me, anyway, I won't put three in the Roper. It just makes things so much harder work.
Yeah, but I like it. If I'm saying legitimate interests, I like to describe what they are. So if I'm doing my Ropers, I'm saying legitimate interest, brackets, you know, whatever it is, you know, what the legitimate interest is, in summary, in the Roper. Otherwise, again, somebody else picks up, looks at it and thinks, well, what is that?
Yeah.
And if they've got a different view of what that legitimate interest is to me, and then they go back and have a look at the privacy information, it all starts to unravel. So I get it about data validation, but, you know, I think the more, to an extent, you know, to this tipping point, I suppose, the more you put in your rows in your ROPA to explain the processing, the better. So processors, you know, recipients, data processors, internal companies, group companies, which ones, where are they, what for? You know, well, you put all that in the, that's why I don't like Excel, you put all that in one cell in Excel, and it just becomes really hard to see what's going on, really, to manage.
Yeah, do you think maybe you could put, like, if you do use an Excel, you could attach data flow, data flow diagrams to the spreadsheet to try and visualize it.
Not easy to attach to a spreadsheet. You know, you can attach.
I guess you could save it somewhere, couldn't you? Is that what you're going
to
say?
You could put a link to a SharePoint file, you know, in an Excel spreadsheet. But again, that's multiple sets. But what if you've got four or five different things? You know, then I know you can use, is it Control or Alt Shift to get a separate line within a cell to break it up into paragraphs. But, you know, then somebody will shrink it up, or shrink it that way, and just becomes. Anyway, enough of Excel and things. Embedding objects, says David.
That doesn't mean anything to me, I don't think.
It's how you add a file to Excel. So you don't choose the path, you embed an object, and then you select as an icon, and it actually puts the file as a complete construct inside the Excel file, so you can open and use it as a file later.
All right.
It becomes part of that one. It's for some reason, it's under, I think it's text. It's embed text. Right. Last option, embed text, object, and you pick a file. Try that.
All right. Perfect. Thank you. I'll have a play with that.
Lots of audit reports done with lots of additional documents added to for signing and things like that. That's where I use it a lot.
Right.
Yeah.
Oh, very clever. Very clever. The other thing is, of course, if you're working on a SharePoint online version of Excel, the, you know, Control D fill down, Control R fill right don't work. It's just, anyway, let's move on, shall we?
Yes.
What were we talking about? Come on, we were talking about,
we've been talking about consent withdrawal for a lot. Yeah. I don't have anything else to add to that. I don't think there was. I don't know if what you want to talk about, but there was a news story that I know you put in the notes that actually really kind of interested me, and it was around Apple's encryption.
Yeah, I'll come on to that. Just I'm gonna have a rant now. Soapbox time, I'm afraid. So, I read a news story in Metro, right?
Yeah.
And apparently, at Caernarfon Crown Court, Judge Nicola Jones was some guy had had his phone nicked, and the police wouldn't give him it back. And the judge said, "Hang on, let me read this." The judge asked the prosecutor if he was having difficulty getting a victim's phone back because of GDPR. And he replied, the prosecutor replied, "It would not surprise me." She then said, "Well, that's ridiculous. It won't be returned. It seems nonsensical. I'm ordering them to give the phone back." And the police are there going, "We didn't say that. You know, we held on to evidence until after the court case in case we need to present it in court and make sure it's not damaged or tampered with." But I mean, why do people get the GDPR so wrong? Why do they give it such a bad rap? This is a judge in the judicial system, you know, having basically, my view, having a go at the GDPR, saying, "Oh, I wouldn't be surprised if, you know, if it's because of the GDPR." Well, the police don't even comply with the GDPR, Christ's sake. I mean,
but I think this just highlights the point that people don't understand the law. It's they see it as a rush, you know, they automatically think that it's, you know, cumbersome red tape is what we often see, isn't it, in reports from the ICO and cutting out all of that nonsense. But it doesn't restrict you, it just puts provisions in place that make sure you have to put safeguards, I guess, in place to enable the free flow of transfer of data. It doesn't restrict you, it enables you. It just puts
a framework around
it to make sure that it's done so in the interests of the individual, not the organization.
So that really irritated me, if I'm being honest.
No, I can imagine. To be honest, I saw a very, very similar thing on LinkedIn that was really quite frustrating. It was a little bit of LinkedIn beef, shall we call it. It was some individual posted an interesting piece from Mario Draghi. It was to do with apparently the costs of complying with GDPR, for example, are estimated to have reduced profits for small European tech firms by up to 12%. And the individual then said, no idea if it's true, but GDPR has nearly ruined the seamlessness of the internet. And now someone I follow on LinkedIn called Tim Turner, I'm sure many people on here know who Tim is. He's not afraid to put his opinion across.
No, he's a very good privileged practitioner and is quite outspoken, and quite rightly.
Yes, absolutely. And anyway, he went and responded to the individual in the comments, and they went through a little bit of back and forth and saying he was kind of with the impression that the GDPR, you know, is hindering organizations in relation to the cookie compliance. And Tim's point was, well, the GDPR doesn't even mention cookies. It's a different regulation that you kind of even bothered around. But it was just a lot of back and forth, and the conclusion that I'm kind of coming to is that, you know, you've got these people who are kind of posting these things on LinkedIn kind of slagging off the laws that we work in, and they just don't understand them. You know, they're saying that the GDPR is restricting organizations and it's, you know, reducing profits of up to 12%, but where do they get these fees from?
I think undoubtedly there is a cost to managing data and having a governance framework around it. I mean, I think there is definitely a cost, whether it's 12%, but I mean, that cost is potentially an enabler as well. You know, it's not necessarily just a cost, it's an investment in customer trust and in making sure that, you know, data is more heavily protected. Arguably, if you invest in it properly, then it's going to suppress and stop data breaches and security issues. But nobody generally sees it that way, do they?
No, they business first, isn't it, as opposed to protecting the individual's rights, which is obviously what the law's for, but people just don't see it that way, do they? Unfortunately.
No. So you were going to talk through Apple's encryption. So, this has been on the roll for a couple of weeks, hasn't it, where under the Snooper's Charge, the Investigatory Powers Act, the government has instructed Apple to provide it with a backdoor to encrypted data. Is that pretty much a summary of the situation?
Yeah, that was what I read. But what I was trying to work out was why the UK wants to do this. There was a couple of things on my mind. There was one, why does the UK government want to access Apple's users' data on iCloud? I couldn't find a reason for doing so. And then kind of the other point that I was kind of thinking is that, what's the difference between this and Pfizer that the US has in place?
Ah, well.
And then that brings me on to the third point, is that if the EU, the reason the EU didn't give the US adequacy, not the only reason, but one of the main reasons, was because of things like Section 702 of the Pfizer, which allows American intelligence services the ability to access data without authorization of the data subjects. What's the difference between that and this? And then why doesn't this threaten our adequacy with the EU?
Oh, crikey. Yeah, good. All good points, I think. I guess the driver is about counter-terrorism, isn't it? I guess, you know, and anti-money laundering and, you know, so fighting crime, that'll be the basis of it, which is why it's been requested under the Investigatory Powers Act, this access.
Yeah.
There's only, what, two, is there now, operating systems in the
I'm not sure.
world? Well, there's Android and there's Apple. I don't know if there's any others, yes. But, you know, I don't know if people still use BlackBerry or
I'm unsure, probably somewhere, yeah, but they're the two main
Nokia
ones, aren't
or they? Something. But yeah, there's and you know, so if you need access to those systems, or, you know, so there's only two systems, aren't there, you know, so
yeah,
terrorists and criminals, if they're using mobile phones, have got to use one of those two systems if they want to use phones.
But, yeah, I mean, I guess probably some of the questions that I'll have will be answered when I actually understand what they're actually doing with the data, but it just seems excessive to me to have access to everybody. Is it going to kind of...
That's not the one. I don't think that's what they want. I think, well, I don't know actually, but you know, I would have thought that currently the framework is that if they want access to the records, they have to get a court order, don't they? Yeah.
Yeah.
But I think what that means next is that Apple can't refuse that court order. You know.
Okay.
Right.
So
but
it's
I did
like,
read.
Sorry, is it a case of if like a phone was to pop up with certain words, for example, would that then like trigger the
I would
need
have
for the UK
even,
to access
no, I would
it?
Have thought, well, I don't. I would not have thought that would be how it would operate. I would have thought that, again, I don't know, Joe, I'm making a lot of assumptions. I would have thought that it would work on the basis that, you know, they think, the authorities think that you and I have got a sideline growing cannabis somewhere, you know, and we're using our Apple phone to communicate this. Yeah. And, you know, they've got good reason to believe that this is what's going on, and they want access to our phone records. So apply to the courts. Courts go to Apple, say these two numbers we need access to, rather than it being a blanket. But I might be wrong. But I did read quite an interesting article in the Washington Post, which was taking huge amounts of umbrage that the cheeky UK might even have considered asking for this kind of right from Apple. And that made me think about, well, hang on a minute, what about Pfizer?
Yeah, I know. And the news article that I read, I think they said that it's to do with a massive invasion of the US's, you know, people's privacy rights. But then, you know, on the other hand, so if you're that worried about your rights in relation to data protection and privacy, why do you not have adequate laws in place to facilitate that?
Joe Kirk, telling you. There's a red spot on your chest there. Hang on a sec.
It just seems really kind of ironic, doesn't it, almost, that the kind of the US are becoming kind of worried about this. Lawrence has put a few things in the chat saying it's in part to overcome the user refusing to provide their password to open the phone. And Pfizer is a court order, so you have to get this signed off, and it is contestable. It is the realm of law, not necessity.
Yeah. Now, we talk about the... I mean, there's a lot more in the chat I want to come back to in a minute, but I did read quite an interesting article about a landmark lawsuit in Texas, where the Texas Attorney General has filed a lawsuit against a company called Allstate Corporation and one of its subsidiaries for things. Covert data harvesting, that's basically embedding software to track metrics like location, movement, and speed in vehicle drivers, and they had over 40 million users, and it was all done without anybody knowing about it. They're saying that in Texas, under the new Texas data protection law, this is considered to be sensitive data, geographic location information, and has to be processed with consent. Also, failing to provide clear and accessible privacy notices, lack of transparency, and then unauthorized selling of the sensitive data. Which is quite interesting because this is the first lawsuit to be brought under this new law, which only came into effect last year. And it's just going to be really interesting to see how that plays out and where that goes and whether there's any presidential interference in the course of the court case. Because we slag off America, don't we, all the time about weak laws. Yeah, you know, here we've got, you know, an authority actively taking action against, you know, a US company for privacy violations, which should be applauded.
I agree. I guess the kind of the premise of why we do slag them off is because why it takes so long to implement something that we feel is so important, you know,
and it's fragmented.
And data protection law has been it's been around for a long time, hasn't it? I mean, we often joke when you've done a few things for us internally about kind of looking back at the years of data protection. Was it Young's and somebody in the 80s? But it goes even further back than 60s. That, doesn't it? Yeah, the 60s. The premise of data protection has been around for a long time. So I guess kind of the premise of why we slag off the US is because why is it taking them until 2024 to implement a data protection regulation, I guess?
Yeah, it's just state by state, isn't it? But that was quite interesting. I saw that. So, you know, that's kind of saying good on you, America, you know, get crack on, you know.
Giving them plaudits.
Yeah. Right. What else have you been up to this week or seen this week? Anything interesting? I'll tell you what I was looking at. I was looking at the IAP course in it's CIP CIPT, the technical course. So they have CIPE. No, they have CIP, yeah, E, don't they? Which has got different variations. Chinese, I think Asian, EU, and there's another one maybe. So different variation courses for the data protection law. And then they have CIPM, which is for management of data protection. They have CIPT, which is meant to be kind of a technical course for privacy. And I just wondered if anybody had done it, because I was having a look at the course breakdown, and it wasn't quite what I thought it was going to be. Because I was tempted to sign up for it and do it and see what it was like, really, because I thought it might benefit, you know, some people. So if I had a first-hand knowledge of it, then I thought it might be useful. But I don't know if anybody's been on that particular course, the technical course. It seems to look at privacy-enhancing technologies and privacy by design. It doesn't really go into the technology per se. It goes, stays above the technology, I think. But I'm just interested to hear. Joanna says she's done it some time ago. I don't know if it was any good, you know, if it was beneficial to do, whether it gave you that knowledge of how to apply GDPR to technology. Okay, if you don't want to come on and say there's a lot of questions in there. But anyway, I was having a look at that. So I'm keen, and they have a brochure for what you cover, which is how I know what it covers, because it's got kind of like it's knowledge base or something. Anyway, I just throw that out.
I've not seen it, so I can't comment, unfortunately.
Yeah. In case anybody has got anything to say about it.
It's IAP, isn't it? CIPPE. Is it CIP?
Yeah. IAP, the International Association of Privacy Professionals, Practitioners.
I do. Yeah, I've seen a little bit of, not backlash, but I've seen some quite negative comments around I think it's the CIPPE that I've seen some people say that the test, I think the test of it, is it multiple choice?
I don't know, because I've not done it, but I should imagine that at least an element of it would be.
Yeah, I'm sure I've seen people saying that it's kind of multiple choice, and it doesn't really, because obviously it's, I know I shouldn't say this because there is no such thing as it, but it is seen by employers as kind of the gold standard.
The gold standard, yeah.
Of a data protection practitioner, even though we all know that it's nonsense, isn't it, really? But, you know, a multiple choice thing, I've just seen a lot of backlash from people, from practitioners who have completed it, saying that it doesn't really hold any weight and it doesn't really provide you with the opportunity to kind of pick apart the law and kind of dissect it and apply it in a way that you would in practice.
Yeah, but I don't think it aims to do that. When I did my practitioner certificate in data protection in about 1998, maybe. Can't remember when I did it. I did it with PDP, and it was a fantastic course. And I had to do like 4 days in a classroom in Manchester, which was great. But the test, there's two tests a year, one in London, one in Edinburgh. And the test, again, was 40 questions, multiple choice or something. But then you had to write a number of essays, like 2 or 3 essays about a scenario. And Sean's saying that this IAP is also scenario-based. And it was quite a tough exam to do. I don't think that the IAP CIPPE sets out to be a hugely academic qualification and enable you to critically appraise and analyze the law. You'd need to go on and do a different level of qualification for that, like a master's. We've talked about this, haven't we? You and I doing a master's in data protection law and practice.
Yes.
So it's good what it does, but it is a bit funny it being considered to be the gold standard. If you haven't got that, I've had people ask me, have you got CIPP? No, I haven't got CIPP. Oh, what qualifies to be a data protection practitioner then? Well, you know, a whole host of academic qualifications that I've taken 4 years studying for, you know.
And your 20 years experience of working in the field.
Yeah. So somebody's saying that the PDP was more advanced than I have. PDP is a British company as well, isn't it? I think it's really good. And the guy that, I don't know if it's still the case, but the guy that owned it or started it, Peter Davies, is it? He's written the de facto manual, the guidebook for decades on data protection law.
Oh, right. I'm not aware of that, but I do use PDP's newsletter. It's very good.
Yeah, it's really good. And they used to do a conference. Again, their conference was fantastic. The best conference in this field, I thought. You know, but I haven't been to it for 3 years. The book is called something like the Data Protection Practitioner's Handbook. I've got it, third edition and the fifth edition. One's orange and one's blue. That's all I can tell you. But I'll find out.
I wonder if Kate's got that in a drawer, because I know she has books. She's bought a couple of books around data protection. I don't know if that's one of them that she's got.
I'll have a look.
Yeah. Well, while you're doing that, shall we move on to, yes. Well, the chat's going a little bit nuts, a little bit kind of people saying experience is more advantageous than a piece of paper. Absolutely agree, Amy. But unfortunately, kind of the premise that I'm coming from is that, you know, if you're applying for a job in the field of data protection, I think recruiters very unfairly kind of, if they, like you said, Phil, people, they ask for that. If they don't see it, they kind of disregard you as a person. And I think just it's an issue probably with recruiters as opposed to the certification. But I just think it sets a little bit of a dangerous precedent of perhaps moving away from people who, just because they haven't got the accreditation, doesn't mean that they're not competent in what they do.
Yeah. So I put a link into on Amazon. For some reason, I got the second edition from November 2008. I know there's been a third, fourth, and I think a fifth edition as well. But Peter Carey is the author, and you know, it's a good book. It's a good book. Of course, the old editions don't cover GDPR. They're all Data Protection Act 98.
Yes. Now there was a news story that I saw. That Kate actually sent to me just before I came on here about Google's fingerprinting techniques. Are you familiar with it at all?
Yeah, vaguely. Vaguely.
Well, the ICO responded to Google's announcement to use its advertising products, saying that it will no longer prohibit them from employing fingerprinting techniques. And the ICO said that businesses do not have free rein to use fingerprinting as they please. Like all advertising technology, it must be lawfully and transparently deployed. And kind of the premise of what fingerprinting is that it takes pieces of information about a device's software or hardware, which then combined with a unique identifying can uniquely identify a particular device and user. So the ICO's view that it was, you know, not fair means of tracking users online because people, you know, likely to not have a choice and control over how their information is collected. And they said that they think it's irresponsible of Google, because they previously said that fingerprinting does not meet users' expectations for privacy, as users cannot easily consent to it as they would cookies. This means in turn that they cannot control how their information is collected. To quote Google's own position on fingerprint from 2019, we think this subverts users' choice and is wrong. So I wonder what's made them kind of go back on that, but apparently they're engaging with Google on
that. I heard that. I found the latest edition of this book. I'm going to put it in here, from November 2020. It's a much, much longer link on Amazon. It's expensive though, but the first time I bought this book, it was like 350 quid or something. It's 75 now in paperback back. So I might buy another updated copy. I read something about that, Joe, about them reversing out of fingerprinting. But I honestly can't remember much about it.
No, I mean, that was pretty much the end of it, really. I don't think there was much more to kind of go on than other than the ICO were engaging with Google to kind of see why they've decided to go back.
Yeah. Now, well, I mentioned it a minute ago, but I downloaded and flicked through the ICO's guidance on consent or pay earlier on today. Again, I think that's quite good too. It's 40 pages. Trouble is, when you download these things, you can download it as a PDF, which is what I like. I can print it out, then I can write on it. But it comes down without a cover. It just comes like with like five lines of a contents page. I don't know why they don't put more effort into improving the look and feel of their documentation. Anyway, it's good as a document. Even if you're not into consent or pay, you know, it's quite good the way that it explores the notion of consent and the notion particularly of imbalance of power. So if I find a link to that, I'll put it in the chat. But it's well worth a kind of a diving through, particularly those sections, because it's just, well, yeah, it's thought provoking.
Yeah. Did you have any thoughts on the premise of consent or pay itself? Or is it just a case of that it has some useful stuff in there kind of around managing consent and the imbalance of power?
Well, that's what I found most useful from it. Of course, you read what the ICO's saying about consent or pay and the fact there should be different options, and you know, when you go on somebody's website and that they're not there, you think, all right, well, don't just tell us, you know, do something about it, you know, do about some enforcement action or some, you know, some advisory notice or something. So I did read through the whole kind of thing about, you know, there are alternatives to this, and you could do display advertising that's related to the context of the page somebody's looking at, you know, which is okay as an option. But you know, it's just quite good to read, particularly that bit about imbalance of power, because we talk about it, don't we, about employment scenarios, imbalance of power, but I don't think I've actually seen anything other than this that explores, that articulates any of the arguments about it.
Right, okay, we'll have to do some more reading.
Yes, never ending.
There wasn't much more that I saw in the news.
You said about the Doer Bill meant
to
be getting,
yes,
royal assent.
You just took the words straight out of my mouth. I was about to say the one thing I have said, that the ICO's Emil Keeney, I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing that correctly, is the Deputy Commissioner of Regulatory Policy at the ICO, was interviewed by GRC World Forums, I think it's Governance, Risk and Compliance, I think. And in the interview, they mentioned a few different topics kind of around like AI and the development around that and how it's important around kind of innovation and so on. But another thing that they addressed was the evolving UK regulatory landscape, specifically around the Data Use and Access Bill. And I think they believe that they're going to get royal assent in spring. And now that does align with Chris Pounder's prediction earlier on in the year, saying that he anticipates in May 2025. So, yeah, it's going to be something. I know we say it every time we're on here, but keep an eye on it. I feel like we're always quite useless in terms of being able to provide you with guidance around it, but there's not really much you can do other than to wait to see what it looks like as its final version, because it can be amended, can't it? So
yeah, we can talk about it. I mean, like we did the DPDI, whatever it was called, Bill, you know, and get upset about it, and oh, that's outrageous, why are they going to abolish this and the next thing, and then you know, might not happen, so it might get taken out. But I think we can be aware of it, we can be aware of the implications. Again, is there going to be a lead in time when it gets, if it gets through and gets implemented? You know, so there's what, once we know where it's going, then we'll definitely do some detailed work on it and some detailed chats on here about it, I should imagine.
Yeah, absolutely. Amy says that she believes it needs to be done before the adequacy runs out on June 25th of June or June 2025, possibly June 2025. Regardless, it's June anyway where the adequacy runs out. Yeah,
sometime in June this year, whether it's the 25th of June or June 25th, soon.
2025, thanks Amy. Yeah, we've not heard much about that, have we really? Did they not say last year that they were looking at it in autumn? Autumn last year, they're going to have a look at it. No, or is it the sunset clause runs out autumn this year, is it? I'm trying to remember really notes from podcasts from months ago. I'm going to stop talking before people think, why is Joe rambling?
I can't remember. Now, did you talk about this last week? Did you talk about, there was a case in the Austrian courts, the CJU was asked to arbitrate on, about when a request is considered excessive under the EU GDPR. Did you see that or talk about that?
No, I don't think so.
But basically there was I can't pronounce it, it's all in German, and my German isn't very good. But basically there was a request to put in something like 77 requests of the Data Protection Authority in Austria, subject access requests. And the Data Protection Authority had said that's excessive.
Oh no, we didn't speak about it last week, but we have spoken. You've spoken about it on here with us.
Oh, have I?
Yeah, I'm sure you have.
anyway, the courts have ruled you can't necessarily rule it excessive just because there's a large number.
Yes,
you've got to show that there was an intention to mess about. Basically, that's the bottom line, isn't it?
Yes. Yeah.
No, abusive intention on the part of the requester.
Yes. Sorry to burst your bubble. Burst your bubble.
I don't remember.
On that
don't one. Remember talk. I don't remember talking about that.
Yeah, David said several weeks ago.
Oh, that's why I don't remember. Apologies. Right. Okay. So, what else have we got? And then, what else have we seen this week? Anything that you've seen? I mean, go back to the online ICA's online strategy for tracking. You've talked about that a lot, haven't you? Because out of that has fallen this looking at the next 1,000 websites. But did you read the strategy? Again, I thought the strategy was a bit lame.
No,
really?
No, I don't think I did. Do you want to rejig my memory?
There's a few things. So, they're encouraging publishers to deploy more privacy preserving advertising. They're building on their working cookies to go onto the UK's top 1,000 websites. They're wanting to ensure that non-compliant online tracking does not take place on apps and internet connected TVs. Okay, how, you know, it begs the question. Publishing advice, guidance on the consent to pay, which actually they've done that, so that's one to be ticked off. But it's just all high level stuff and no real I couldn't see any emphasis on action, you know, and I think that personally, I think that they're a bit light on action.
Do you think they do that on purpose, though, to kind of not make false promises saying we're going to do this, this and this, and if they don't meet it, it doesn't look as bad in terms of a reputational side of things?
Well, maybe, but is that what you want? Or do you want, you know?
No, but
I'm not going to commit to anything, so I don't have to be held accountable to it or responsible for it. I'm not sure. Anyway, I read through it, and again, just interested to see how that plays out, because it's a 2025 strategy. So, you know, I think that we're trying to get this all boxed off this year. We'll see how things go. Yeah. So, what have you got on next week, Joe? Are you out and about, or are you?
No, I'm very much in Leeds for the full week next week, unless something changes last minute. I am going to be carrying on with my audit write-up that I've been starting this week. It was a rather large audit looking at an organisation, both as a controller and a processor. So it's a chunky piece of work. So I'm going to be bogged down in that, I think, for the majority of next week, I imagine. Yeah. And then, unfortunately, had to not neglect somewhat out of choice, but yeah, I've not had the time that they deserve at the moment because I've been here, there and everywhere on audit. So hopefully I'll check in with some customers to make sure that they're doing all right. The place hasn't set alight with me not being in touch too much. What about you?
Good. I'm just having a look now. I've got this big black thing on my screen that's got a swirly blue up thing. I don't know what's going on with my computer. So, but next week, it looks like I'm in Leeds on Tuesday, which should be good. I haven't been to the office for a while. Going to catch up with some. I've got to write up your IT audit notes from the audit of the laboratories. So I'm going to do that on schedule that for Wednesday morning. And of course, we're doing budgeting. So we've got to get a grip of the budgets and all the various changes and see what the impact of those is going to be on next year's running of the business. So a busy week.
Exciting.
A busy week. Yes. Yeah. I'm just looking at that Peter Carey book. So it was written in published in November 2020, and it says it covers off the EU exit regulations and the withdrawal agreements. Again, I'm hoping that isn't clutter in that book in the passage of time, that becomes, you know, less relevant, I suppose. So maybe he's got another edition coming out.
Lovely. We'll keep an eye on.
Yeah, we'll see. And I can't see the team anymore. I've just got this big black thing on my screen. So apologies, I can't see if there's anything in the chat or anything. I'll move on to the other screen. That means I'm now looking sideways. So listen, it's now it's 1:30 almost, isn't it? So I'm afraid that we've probably run out of time. We said that we would probably have nothing to talk about this week because it was now in the news, but you managed to have rabbited on for a whole hour.
Yeah, managed to find a couple of decent topics to try and explore. Consent's always a nice one to try and take some time. We spoke quite heavily about consent last week, actually, kind of the notion as to whether the premise of providing dating apps with your personal information, whether that is freely giving consent, seeing as you don't really have a choice these days, as it's the most prominent way to meet people online. But I won't explore that further. I just recommend you go listen to last week's podcast if you want to know mine and Katarina's thoughts around that. It was good, though. I think you'd have really enjoyed last week's session.
Yeah. I was wanted to be on it, actually. It reminds me, I wanted to show you the subscription form for The Times, because I was looking at a news story in The Times this week, and I had to subscribe to get it. It's like consent or pay or subscribe. And then there's an automatic, I mean, I was going to show, which I won't, I have to do it next week, the consent statement, because it was a bit weird, actually. We talked about it earlier, didn't we, you and I?
Yeah.
Not sure it complies fully.
You're not here next week, though, are you? So you have to send it to me.
Well, I'm not sure. It's my 21st birthday, and I was going to... What are you laughing for? And I was going to take the day off, but I'm not sure whether I'll be...
You're just so eager, aren't you, to talk about employee monitoring that you don't want to miss the podcast.
Oh, I'd love to, yeah. I would have liked last week's, because I think that would have been a really good conversation about all sorts of, you know, really fascinating stuff, particularly, you know, like sensitive data that people put in and the expectations of privacy when you're putting it out there for other people to review. So I'm sorry I missed that one. You see, Amy, I call the month this month, I call it February, because all the people born in this month are fab, including us. And on that note, I think it's probably time to bow out, do you think? So, as I say, thank you very much, Joe, for your considered opinions, and thank you everybody else for your considered opinions and for your contributions. It's great to have you at the podcast. Hopefully we'll catch you with you next week. I may or may not be there, depending on how next week goes in general. But in the meantime, have a great rest of Friday and a good weekend.
Cheers, guys. See you later.